So, hi everybody. Welcome along to teach this morning, Tuesday morning, where we're discussing samsara and nirvana. So we engage in these teachings by taking refuge together, generating a mind of enlightenment. We say a few prayers, then the class commences, and during the class there's places we can actually pause and ask questions and also do a meditation. Let's begin with taking refuge and generating a mind of enlightenment. So this requires that you first of all get comfortable in the seat. Ideally, your back is straight, your feet are flat on the floor or on a cushion. Your shoulders will drop down naturally. And your head will be sitting evenly on your neck. Then allow the eyes to sort of either close completely or partially close. So a little bit of light comes through. Let your body breathe itself. And while the body continues to breathe itself, imagine that in the space in front of you appears Shakyamuni Buddha, who is sitting on a throne of gold. Body of the Buddha is made of golden light, and he's wearing the three robes of a fully ordained monk. And surrounding the Buddha are many other enlightened beings. There are other Buddhas, other bodhisattvas, deities, and other spiritual practitioners. In the meantime, you yourself are surrounded by all sentient beings. I think your mother is sitting beside you on the left, your father is sitting beside you on the right. Your good friends and family are behind you, and difficult people are sitting directly in front of you. So recollect that all these people have an equal wish to avoid suffering. They equally wish to be happy, and equally they all lack genuine happiness. And you remember that the causes of suffering can be eliminated. And the potential we have for genuine happiness abides equally within all of us. So to dispel the causes of suffering and actualize genuine happiness, we have to abandon attachment to the fantasies of this life, to all the pleasures of cyclic existence, to our own singular welfare, and to the belief in an independent and objective reality. These possibilities for abandonment can be achieved by all of us. We have to decide that we want to do that and then to do it. Let's now take refuge in those who have done it, the Buddha and the spiritual entourage who've been able to abandon these four objects through applying the teachings, the Dharma. To think that you want to develop your wisdom, compassion, and every other skill you possess to liberate yourself and every other sentient being from suffering and to develop all the good qualities. Now join me in saying, I go for refuge since I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of ours, from the heart of the Buddha and all the other enlightened beings, streams of light and nectar emerge from the heart of each being, and they pour over you and over all the people surrounding you. And this light and nectar sweeps away, washes away every type of spiritual hindrance and obstacle. I think that your potentials for becoming awakened have been awakened. And you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You decide to develop these yourself and to help everyone else do the same. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering in its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And again, imagine the lights of nectar streaming forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. These lights and nectars wash over you and over all the people surrounding you. And they remove every hindrance to your spiritual development. So that these four qualities effortlessly manifest. So you recollect the field of merit above you and prepare yourself to purify the mind, to accumulate and to increase merit. So you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering actually emanating. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all whole and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma from living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now, to stop us clinging to the belief in an objective reality, imagine that your body, speech, and mind, all the merits that you've created, are utterly transformed through your understanding of emptiness. And all these phenomena now appear purely in the state of a wonderful, pure land whereby we can give teachings to others in the future. So we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, stirred with flowers, adorned with Mount Mary, four continents of sun and moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offer. May all human beings enjoy this pure land. So release the offering that's been accepted by the Buddha who smiles at you. You meet his gaze. You feel accepted and at ease. And it seems to you as if every wish you have in terms of your spiritual development will be met. And now an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. And now the emanation descends, coming to rest at the level of your heart, whereby it begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light and nectar. And these now pour out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space, and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. And from within this state, you hear the sounds of the mantra. Into the recite it three times aloud, and then very quietly under your breath. Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamunayas Kayata Om Mani Mani Maha Munaya Svaha. Have a sense that you've accomplished your own welfare and the welfare of others. Acknowledge that this meditation has been one of imagination, which has imprinted the mind. So that you have this potential to fully awaken, to bring about benefit for yourself and others. And you're breathing in through your nostrils, exhale, you open that. Bring your attention back to the class. We'll have a look at our class that we're doing today. So I've relied upon these books. We're sort of going through a section on the Four Noble Truths. So as you know, the topic is samsara and nirvana. And the Four Noble Truths contain both of these topics. So, in terms of the Four Noble Truths, we have the truth of suffering and the truth of origin. These describe samsara, and the truth of path and the truth of cessation describe nirvana. When we looked at these topics, we looked at what samsara is. Can somebody tell me what it is? It's the process of rebirth under the control of karma and delusion. What's another way of describing it? What's an analogy for it? You heard the word, there's an acronym used, SAD. What does SAD stand for? Striving, achievement, disillusionment. This is the samsaric mind. We strive to create phenomena to hold on to them. We do, and then it doesn't work out. Another way of describing samsara is to say it's not quite right. Remember, samsara and nirvana are both states of mind. So samsara is a state of mind that's not quite right. And nirvana, of course, is things are right. And samsara, nirvana speaks to the ultimate nature of the mind. We looked at these Four Noble Truths, which I briefly discussed before, and we looked at the sequence about why it was taught this way. So why was the Four Noble Truths taught in the way it was? Why were causes taught? Why were effects taught before causes? Anybody remember? Yes, we know how to meditate on the topic, basically, how to become familiar with this topic, a very simple way of explaining it. Now, today we're going to have a look at from the truth of suffering, we're going to look at three major categories of suffering. These are called the suffering of suffering, the suffering of change, and the suffering of all-pervasive conditionality. There's a great analogy that describes these three forms of suffering. It's called the burn wound or the wound. We're also going to look at why it's important to become familiar with these three forms of suffering and what sort of impact it will have on us if we do so. So let's look at things today. Let's begin with the first of these sufferings. So I've called it here the dukkha of misery. So like I said, some of this is called the suffering of suffering. And suffering is an English word that's often used to describe another word, and this other word is called dukkha. So there's a relationship between suffering and dukkha. The problem with this relationship is dukkha has many other sort of meanings, has a much sort of deeper meaning than what we normally call suffering. Now, for us, in terms of the word suffering in English, what does it normally refer to? Yeah, been feeling something painful, being unhappy, being distressed, being anxious. These are sort of things that we call suffering. Experiencing grief, what we call lamentation, these sort of phenomena. But you'll see that the Dukkha of Misery is much covers many more things than just that. But this is what we're familiar with. This similar experience is known as the suffering of suffering, and it refers to direct physical or mental pain. And this mental pain or physical pain doesn't require any complex analysis to identify it, right? We know it. When it happens to us, we all know what it feels like to be hurt. And this is the level they're talking about here. This is the first level. Yeah, and it says if you're walking barefoot and you stand on a sharp thorn, you don't need a philosophy degree to know it hurts. Right? It's that obvious to you. This is the level we're talking about. Now, the example we're going to use to demonstrate this first level of suffering is what's called the burn wound. So it includes the painful physical and mental feelings. So you imagine here that you've actually, perhaps you're moving a pot of hot liquid from the stove to the bench. And for whatever reason, you get sort of tips up a bit, and that hot liquid goes down and burns your foot. So that there is what we're talking about here. Now, and that's about it. That's all we need to say here. But if you have any questions, you can. This is just talking about the level of pain that you already know about. Right? Like I said, it doesn't require thinking. It takes place, we feel it, and we go, we have a distressful response to it. Now, there are different ways of responding to this type of pain. What might some of the ways be? Yep, so before we go to the answer, that's a real good Dharma response, that's right. Normally, for a normal person, what normally happens when you get hurt like this?
You mean something like scream?
Yeah, you might just scream out. Huh? You could scream. Huh? You'd verbally articulate your hurt. Yeah. You can blame someone else. I thought you'd be really angry at the pot or the hot water. This is what we do, isn't it? Debbie?
Angela says we might say ouch, and Anthea says you would put ice on it.
Yeah, so we have this response. So what if it's, so this is in terms of physical pain. How about mental pain? Say somebody does something, it's not directly physically, but perhaps you have a daughter or a son or somebody that does something that hurts you.
You either get depressed or angry.
You can become depressed, angry, frustrated, yeah. There's somebody out there that's really hurt me. Have you known people who pretend it hasn't happened? People sort of deny their hurt also, don't they?
Anthea said you can become very protective of yourself, and Angela says you could have a range of emotional responsive reactions and even retaliation.
That's right. All this phenomena can follow from this type of pain. Okay, I think that's something we all know, right? So we get a general idea of this one. Like I said, oftentimes when I read the books, it's just like one sentence. We all know what that is, nothing more to be said, then they move on. So this, when we experience the dukkha of misery, it's painful, it hurts. Right? And this is the feelings that come with it. We have painful or hurtful feelings associated with this. But let's look at our second type of dukkha or suffering. This is called the dukkha of change. And here we're going to start off using the same idea of the wound. Right? So we've had this pot of hot boiling liquid or something. It's slipped or something. It's poured over us. It's hurt us. So we're going through the dukkha of misery. Now, the dukkha of change is follows along from that. So what this means is, so we're hurting and we want to stop hurting, so we do something about that. And in here, what I normally say is, when you get burnt, what's the suggestion for you to do to a burn wound?
Run it under cold water.
Run it under cold water, usually, isn't it? Or get something cold, run it under cold water first, and then maybe find something else that's cold, and you put a cold pack on it or something, doesn't it? And then that decreases the pain, and we feel like much better. Of course, it's momentary. Yes, it changes. So we started off with pain, right? The suffering of pain. So now Ruby is bringing in one of the aspects of this pain, meaning it's changeable, it's momentary. It comes and goes. Now, so this is, relates to the dukkha of change. This ability for pain to change, or pain to change. So one of the ways we can help pain change is by putting cold water on it. If we just leave it alone, it also changes because it can't stay the same. But anyone who's burnt themselves and know the quick way to stop the hurt will quickly put that foot under water or in cold water and get ice and do all sorts of things, don't they? They want to hurry up the process of change. Yeah, so they don't create a change through using application of water or a bandage or a salve or anything like that. So the suffering, the intensity of the first type changes. So this is pretty straightforward, isn't it? So the other day I was up at a hospital seeing a fellow, and he's suffering a great deal, and he's lying in his bed suffering. And his feet were really sore and sort of swollen up. So this is like the dukkha of misery. So he asked me, could you massage my feet? So yeah, sure. So we've got this lovely cream, and we put it on the cream and massage underneath his feet and bend his toes back, and he gets all sloppy. He's going, so good. Feels so good. Right? There's the dukkha of change. Right? We applied an ointment and we gave his feet a massage. And he's happy. So this is the dukkha of change, so first it's called happiness. It's the feeling of pleasure or a relief from pain. So here, for instance, the cooling cream and the cooling waters, it's the lessening of physical and mental painful feelings felt as pleasure or happiness. And you absolutely think about this, isn't it? So it's actually still painful, but because the pain is lessened, we like it. And this is called pleasure. Then you go 8, 7, 6, decrease. You get down to, say, beneath, you get down to 4 or 3, or down to 2. It's like, oh, that's great. That's pleasure. It's both. I heard the guy, I said, those are expressions of pleasure. You have a pleasurable feeling. It's not just relief, because you are relief, but relief would be like 9-8. Right? There's a decrease in the suffering. And then this decrease becomes really noticeable to you. And we call this happy, pleasurable, we use these terms. This is right. It's a completely different way of looking at things too, isn't it? Because we don't usually look at phenomena like that. For us, there's a clear demarcation between what we call pleasure and happiness and the opposite. They're completely different. But here, this is showing you that they're basically on a spectrum, that difference is not in fact true. When you have direct pain, the dukkha of change is not obvious to you. Like when that water pours on your foot, it's just like, right? And it's just like, for real, that's the reality. And it we might know that, it'll decrease because that's what happens over time, I'll get well. But when it's happening, That doesn't arise, does it? When you go to the doctors and so forth, or use the water and the cream, and that whole decrease takes place, it's obvious that you go, oh, right, now I'm feeling better. And you are feeling better. But it's still within the whole, still on the spectrum or within the realm of suffering, isn't it? All that's really happened is the suffering's decreased. And that's what we call like happiness. Yes, it's a very shocking thing when you start thinking about this. Yeah, so all of our states of what we call happiness are actually just states of decreased suffering. Yes, it's a radical, different way of looking at things.
The insensata.
Yeah. So, you know, if we have the samsaric mind, you know, which we do have, then this is our reality. And I was really shocked at this because it seems like there's no way out, or it'll seem even worse for the next one. It'll seem like there's no way out. You're going to say something, Jenny?
And I feel like on some level, we know that the feelings that we call pleasure, we can't hang on to them forever. We have to work really hard to sustain them. And sometimes no matter what you do, you can't sustain them. So there is always that element of pain with it. For example, like, you know, you have to work so hard just to go out to the shops to buy something nice to eat. And then even when you're eating it, like, you know, it has to end eventually. And if you eat too much, you're also back into painful. It's,
yeah,
you
so
can't control it.
Yeah. So this is on like the bad side, right? Obviously using the wound. But this is then he's brought up. You can switch to Costco and just look at the good side. Now we have, say, for instance, chocolate cake, which has been or been a good example. Right? So we're hungry, we're experiencing the suffering. Now we get some chocolate cake. And we go, oh, great. And as soon as we take it, right, our suffering diminishes, decreases immediately. And with that very same bite, we feel start feeling better. But as you've said, this, you can't hold on to it because it's impermanent. It's going to change. If you don't have another bite, you've got to get hungry again. So the suffering of hunger returns. If you keep eating, you have pleasure. But if you keep eating too much, you're going to get the suffering of a full stomach and nausea and perhaps sickness. And the cake itself has no power to keep us happy, as we all know. Right? We often spend our lives on chasing moments of comfort, believing they're the key to lasting happiness. We assume that if we just get the right job or partner or meal, we will finally be satisfied. However, even our best days have a hidden quality of unease. This is because the happiness we find in the world is not a stable state. It's just a temporary shift in our circumstances. You'll notice this all the time once you start paying attention. You know, we've all experienced moments of happiness, right? Or joy, right? How long does it last for? It's like that. It really is. If you really pay attention, it's like, gee, it's there and it's already going downwards. And very quickly, just return to your normal state. And, you know, I can think of so many different examples. I hope you can too if you think about this. Yes, yeah, so I remember one time. So this dukkha of change is, I'm just trying to think of, wondering about my own examples I want to give to you and thinking, are these appropriate for the class? Because I'm quite familiar with this one here. And, you know, like how it just doesn't, how having more of the thing you like, it doesn't work. It brings other problems along with it. But if you've checked this out yourself and see, it is like this. You don't have to believe this. You can sort of check it out yourself in your own experiences and go, oh, yeah, I've experienced all of that. And they say these types of like worldly happiness. So, like, for instance, we use the idea of a chocolate cake or having more money, having more of something, right? And we've got it, it feels good, and we want to maintain that good feeling. There's a great simile they use in the text, and this is the one where they say, the pleasures that you experience, which are dependent upon your senses. So let's say the chocolate cake. What makes that chocolate cake so nice to eat? Advertising? The flavour of the cake?
The hunger.
Your own hunger? That's right. If you're full, it doesn't taste anywhere near as good as if you're hungry, eh?
The packaging,
and what it looks like, what's over the cream, the type of chocolate. So all of those is like, so those, all those phenomena depend upon a number of your senses, aren't they? One is your eyes. There's a big difference if you're looking at a chocolate cake and if they're cold, if they're closed and someone says, have a piece of chocolate cake. Right? If they're open, it's much more delicious, isn't it? And of course, you've actually got to put it onto your, into your mouth. So that depends upon the nerves and so forth in the tongue and around the mouth and all that stuff. Plus, you know what? If you have blocked up nose, you can't actually taste the food. So you need to have like a clear airway as well. Yeah? And in fact, we in the West maybe have a really good relationship with chocolate. we as soon as we see it, we natural thing love it, we like it. So, but if you show it to a Tibetan, you're going to look at, like, what is that? That looks a little bit murky, doesn't it? It's just dark chocolate and thing. And when they eat it, they don't like it. The cake, all the material in the cake is changing, and you yourself are changing. There's nothing stable within your body and mind that stays the same, and there's nothing stable about that cake. But all the two phenomena which are in the process of change, then they're going to come together, right? So I had this happen to me quite a few years ago when I was living at the centre. I lost the ability to smell, and then my weight just dropped. I was just like, why? I don't feel like eating. I can't smell the food. Put it in your mouth, you can't taste it.
Enjoyment is gone.
Enjoyment is gone. So why would I want to do something I get no enjoyment from at all? So, of course, start losing weight. Yeah, I had to go and have it. Yep, I did. I got an operation, and it was amazing to be able to smell. Gosh, and taste food again. My gosh, the taste of food is highly dependent on the old mouth. And until it happened, I had no real idea that that was the case. And so they give us an analogy of the saying that worldly pleasures are like drinking salty water. Mm. And I think it's a great analogy. Because like when you're thirsty, you want to drink, right? But imagine you drink water that's salty, and think that it doesn't taste so salty, you can actually drink it, right? But it makes you more thirsty. Right? You get the refreshment of the liquid in your mouth and you swallow it, but it's actually creating more thirst. And so you have to sort of keep doing it. And you can't be satisfied. And this is what this Dukkha of Change is talking about. It's not satisfactory to have phenomena that are changing all the time, and for us to go, oh, that can make me happy.
There's always a bit of anxiety that goes with it, because when we have something good and it's gone and we want it again, then suddenly you're like, oh, how do I get it again? What do I have to do to get it again? And you don't realize it's there, but there's that undercurrent of unhappiness that goes with trying to get more happiness.
Yeah, there is. So one way you can practice this is, like, you know, all of us in the morning, I think most of us like to have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, some sort of liquid thing in the morning. So just next time you have one, try to notice the moment the enjoyment shifts to neutrality or craving. This is a simple thing to do. You'll take your first cup and you're like, oh, no, I love my first sip of tea in the morning. You make that, especially if someone else makes it for you. Doesn't always seem better. But, so you have that cup of tea and you take that first sip and it's like, so nice. Then you put it down and then just watch what happens to the taste. You know, it's just a way of checking this what they call Dukkha of Change. And one of the questions that come up through looking at this Dukkha of Change is that if your current happiness requires constant maintenance to prevent it from turning into pain, Can this truly be called like happiness? So you're saying something, this is just where I'm sort of really confronting this, I think. You know, let's have a look at the next one, but it's even more confronting. I only just got my head around about it this year after teaching it for so long. And this type of suffering or dukkha is called the dukkha of all compounded misery. So first of all, this word compounded just means when two things come together, when a number of different things come together, it'll have this be miserable. And this is associated with a feeling of equanimity. So remember our first one, the suffering of pain, that's associated with painful feelings, isn't it? Unlikable feelings, things we're averse to. Suffering of change is related to our happiness. And now this one is like, it's not happiness and it's not suffering. It's somewhere sort of like on the spectrum, we can't sort of discern which one it is. It's not bright enough for us to go, oh, I feel good. And it's not so harsh enough that we say, oh, I feel bad. It's basically what we're all feeling right now. So if you look at what's going on in your body-mind continuum, ask yourself, do you feel really happy sitting here like this? Yeah, no, not particularly. It's just normal sort of, you know. Do you feel really sad, upset? No, it's just, it's ordinary. Well, this is what that is, the sense of equanimity. In terms of the burn wound, we've put the ointment on, right? It's like we felt, now we feel happy, better, pleasure. And then we just, it just sort of goes like, now I don't feel any pain there. But you touch it, boom, up she goes. He says, while we easily recognize physical pain or the sadness of losing something we love, the most profound level of dissatisfaction is pervasive conditioned suffering. This is the fundamental state of having a body and a mind that are not under our direct control. Instead, they are other-powered, driven by past habits and the biological reality of aging and decay. You're laughing. I have to laugh till you get older. This is all true, right? And you'll pick it up. So, driven by past habits, that's what we talk about, karma. And then just the fact that the body's a biological thing, it's under its own causes and conditions, not under ours. Pervasive suffering is sort of like the background radiation of existence. It's like our background, we're not aware of it. Like I said, we're just sitting here. Doesn't seem like we're suffering, does it? Are we really, really happy? No. So if you just stay sitting here, it won't take long before the suffering of change is, sorry, the suffering, first of all, of pain is going to arise. And what you say, perhaps my body. I've just got to stay sitting here, right? So we have to change it, right? So then we'll stand up. And then we'll feel better. But if we keep standing, our feet are going to get sore, aren't they? Trying to get the suffering of suffering again. So we have to change it. We have to sit down again. But why is this, these two things going on all the time? Well, because of this. Because we have a body and a mind that are not under our complete control. And it's not just that. We have a body and a mind that are not under our control, and we're saying, basically, this body and mind that's not under my control, that's mine. That's me. So we have grasping or believing that our body and mind is me, or that we own this body and mind as a real, real thing. This is the, oh, I said, man, this is what I got the other day. I was like, oh my gosh, this is where it starts. Right? Because actually, you know, how we act, what we actually are, we're called I, aren't we? Or the person. We're a person or an I, the self. Well, that's an identity, and it's imputed to the body and mind. It's like a label put on this thing that we call a body and mind. We go, that's me. So this man then like appropriates it, grabs it, says, yeah, this is me, this is who I am. But what you're doing is grabbing onto something or holding something that's not under your control and thinking, oh, that's me. Right? And I do control my body and mind. Don't we normally think that? You know, we have our parents tell us to control ourselves. We go, okay, well. Yeah. But it only goes so far, doesn't it? We don't have complete control. You know, sometimes, you know, many times, like mum and dad tell us not to use bad language, we might be pretty good and not do it. But then you get hurt suddenly, and next thing, swear word comes out of your mouth. Right? So, yeah, I had no control over that. You know, there's we often find ourselves saying sorry. If we had some sort of control, we wouldn't need to, would we? Yeah, so the body has its own causes and conditions, this physical, you know, phenomena. If we believe it to be ours or mine, then we're taking, I mean, you can imagine the suffering that's going to take place when you die. Because like you say, right, you're saying this is me, you'll see yourself getting skinnier and skinnier and skinnier, you won't be able to lift your legs or your arms, it's going to hurt like crazy, and you're going to like, grasping at that to be me. This is a very, people do this, of course, but we should be able to, sort of, after our studies and so forth, perhaps diminish that, you know, decrease the craving or the belief that our body is me. And it's the same sort of thing when we do it with the mind. You know, like I said again, these phenomena exist, but not, but often not in the way that we normally think they do. But, you know, most of us would never think, would we, that our happiness is just a decrease in our dissatisfaction. Like, who thinks that normally? But this, you know, if you can remember this in your mind, guess what? This little happiness and feeling is going to change again and go into neutrality or indifference, neutrality. But if something happens, we're going to get upset again.
And sometimes we don't even realize, like just on a very gross level that we do, you know, for example, if a marriage falls apart, you don't realize how much of an identity you held as I'm a married person, mm-hmm. or this person was my partner. And it's not too bad person that's gone, or, you know, through loss or whatever, then you realize, oh, I had this crazy idea that that's who I had to be. And that's really even on a gross level, not even.
I get what you're getting at. So there's, it's like, the terms they use for it is like a continuum of change. Right? So like, you've had this body since you're born. You've had a body. Since we've all had a body since we were born, isn't it? We come into this world, we came out of our mother's womb, we had a body then. And it was changing all the time. It had to come out. And it came out and it started changing until we find here we are. So that's a whole, what they call a continuum from our birth, or even before birth, to birth, to where we are now. But the body that we had when we were a child, the body we have now, is definitely not the same body. In fact, it's probably changed, like a whole lot has changed over seven times. I think it's
every
7 years, any part that you first started with is gone. It's completely new parts. Right, so if you're above 50, you've had a complete overhaul seven times. What has stayed constant through? Your name. However, it's also possible you might have changed your name. Right? So what's even more deeper than stayed the same? The name I. But this stable, it's just imputed to the body and mind. Body and mind, as it makes all these changes, the I has to change too. No, that's the Western science have discovered that, yeah. So just what you're going to get here is just the fact that you've got this body and mind, and we call it human body, human mind, we're a person. What's it called? This a compounding has taken place. So what's been compounded here is what it means is that there's a number of different parts that have come together. So the parts here are the body and the mind and the identity. These three have come together.
Again, just our
thoughts
about it.
No, I.
Yeah.
Like Gerald, Geraldine, the name that you give to these things. And as I was saying, so over time you might have changed your name a couple of times, right? But the sense of I is, by the way, all through, isn't it? You just say, yeah, when I was younger I was called Robin, but when I got older I was called Robert. Right? And then a little bit later people call me Uncle Bob. But you know, you'll say, yeah, I am Uncle Bob or I am Robert. And once I was called Robin or Robin. And so we've got the name. That you can change that, but it's always put to this body and mind, a single body and mind. It's also undergoing change all the time. And of course, you can't stop change. None of us, when you're born, you know, anybody seen the movie The Tin Drum? So in this film, a really good film, this boy is so dissatisfied with the conditions of the world. He looks at it and goes, this is a terrible world. I never want to grow up into it. And so what happens, he falls down the stairs and he stops growing. And it's a story about this, it looks like a boy, but there's a man in there. Man's intelligence, but he just grows up as this little kid. You know, sorry, he stays very short, at the same time as a child, but he's an adult. And this book was written, it's about growing up in Nazi Germany. And you see this person, like I said, I don't want to grow up. Can you stop yourself growing up? We can't, can we? And we can't stop ourselves dying, and we can't stop ourselves being born. It's all out of our hands. We can't, you know, we can, many times we can't stop ourselves getting sick, we can't stop ourselves from aging. So many things, by having the body and mind like this, is really, there's a lot of things that we can't do. So it's not, in other words, it's saying here, look, your body and your mind, they're not completely under your control. In fact, I remember one time when I knew I was dying, you know, and I was telling myself, breathe, just breathe, and you'll be okay. I was saying that, and my body did not listen to me. I was just sitting there kind of like, boom. They rushed me off to the hospital and got me back to life. But that was a great wake-up thing to me, because I always thought, like, I had control. It was my, if I could just have a strong enough mind and will and do what I want. But that day I discovered, no, can't. And I couldn't even get my body to breathe for me, even though I was instructed it to. So here's something else you might practice to have a look at. Perform a control inventory. Yeah. List three things about your body you cannot change by command. You recognize that this lack of autonomy is the foundation of your vulnerability. Yeah. But, you know, one of the most simplest ones is that we can't stop ourselves aging. There's one. We can't stop ourselves dying. So there's two. find one more. For someone to think about and go, okay, these ways I can acknowledge I don't have control. Which is a real good thing to know, right? Because if you can't have control, then trying to get control over some of these things would be ridiculous, wouldn't it? Because you can't do it. Can't be done. No, because often what happens, of course, is your body will disregard your instruction and start to breathe, isn't it? Even though people have tried. You can stop yourself from eating and you can stop yourself from drinking. Because people have done that, right? If you decide I'm going to die, it's your decision. You'll stop eating, you'll stop drinking, and you can do that. But you can't stop, you know, the dying process or the aging process. Yes, yeah, so you know, these things aren't meant to be like morbid meditations. It's just like the facts, right? We're just trying to get used to, gee, I never thought of that before. And is this true? And so forth. We can cover and go, okay. So it's not science fiction or something. I can agree. I can't stop myself from aging and these sort of things. Now, this, of course, this analogy of the burn room is to demonstrate those three different forms of suffering. So in terms of all pervasive conditional, it's just that the fact that you've got this human body means it can be burnt by boiling water and hurt you. You'll be hurt by it. And the state that, like, if you think, okay, I've got this body and it's not hurting now, well, pour some boiling water on yourself and you'll soon find very quickly it's hurting then. Right? So it has, this body has the nature of being able to be harmed, in this case, by the hot water. And so the state of neutrality will quickly change into a state of pain. And of course, because we don't like pain, we want to stop that. Okay, then I'll need to grab some cold water, ice, some balm and so forth. And you can put that all over it. Of course, still, it requires the body to heal. But again, it's out of your control. If you don't put the cool water on and the balm, it's going to take longer to heal and it will hurt you longer. But still, the body has to do it, doesn't it? You might have heard many times ago, the doctors are saying, as many, you know, the body, it heals itself. They sort of give their help a little bit, but for many cases, it's the body heals itself. We don't. And the doctors can't in many cases. But somehow or other, the body does. But you also know sometimes it doesn't. Something else happens, and you know some types of diseases there are, which is, you'll be dead pretty quickly. So we start with, like I said, this one, there's misery, there's change, and there's the suffering of the all pervasive compounding conditions. So again, just open up for any questions for a little bit. Anybody would like to say something about this?
Yeah.
So as you brought up here, Sally, so there's a number of different types of equanimity. So this other we just call like the equanimity of feeling. So Sandy's now talking about equanimity that you can actually practice, which is a different form of equanimity. But you come to this idea of practicing because you know the other one. You know that, just because I'm not experiencing suffering right now, I think, well, I'm okay. But you could experience it at any moment because you've got a body and mind that's like the source of the suffering. No. It's the system you're talking about here. But in the Mahayana, no. Okay. So what do you think so far? Does it seem a bit like... Venerable Rabina used to say, the suffering or all pervasive suffering of conditionality. He said, this is the, that we exist like this by nature. So whenever I heard that, to me it always seemed like, then there's no way out. You know, like, it's just terrible. Why would I even think about this? But that's not quite the meaning of it. What it means by nature here is that it is suffering by nature because it is produced by causes associated with suffering. If you have the causes of suffering, you must get the effect of suffering. But just like you have the causes for happiness, you must get the effect of happiness. So here we've got this body and mind called samsara, because it's not under our control. Some of the control of karma and delusion. So one of the reasons, it depends upon which system you look at. So in the Pali tradition, impermanence is seen as a source of suffering.
Yeah.
It's called suffering, no? But not in the Mahayana. If you go like, why? Yeah, okay, take the mind of a Buddha. Does it change? Of course it does. It's a mind. All minds are subject to change. Oh, we'll just put that aside for a moment. So let's just go back to here. If you are a fully enlightened being, you have a mind and you have a body. The question is, okay, does the mind change? You know, the conventional nature of mind, of course it does. If it doesn't change, you can't get at anything. So the Buddha's mind is just like our mind in terms of the conventional nature. It is changeable, changes from moment to moment to moment. In all those changes, Is suffering ever produced? No. Why? Because the causes aren't there. So you still have a mind that's impermanent, right? But it doesn't have any causes within it to produce any suffering. So when we talk about the feelings anti-associated with these, so the feeling in terms of, suffering of suffering, the feeling is one of pain, hurts. It's an uncomfortable feeling. When the suffering decreases, now we call it a feeling of happiness, a positive feeling, because the negative has decreased enough for us to go, oh, now I feel much better. The other one, what we're talking about here about equanimity or neutrality, is that we can't discern, like I said, this is actual suffering or is it happiness? You don't classify in either one of those. Like I was saying here, when you're sitting here asking, what are you feeling now?
Nice.
Yeah, neither. That's right. Do you have the, does this body and mind have the potential to feel good or feel bad? Yes. So there we have the three types of feeling. If something is altered, you will feel happy or unhappy. But at present, it's neutral. It's equanimous. That's all about that. Yeah.
So Eddie, are you what you're saying is, as long as we have this ordinary body, it's almost like a magnet for suffering.
Yeah, it is. It's out of the sky.
Ordinary.
So the Buddha will not experience any of these three types of suffering, will they? He doesn't have an ordinary mind either, so he's not going to experience those three types of mind. But if it's, imagine the Buddha's mind is permanent, right? Like somebody might have suggested. What's the problem with that then? It
doesn't change.
It doesn't change, can't change at all.
And then how could it help anyone?
How could it help anyone? So this is why I say, so depending on the tenet system, like you said, we look at, so some of them, like I said, the major thing is, in the Pali tradition, they classify impermanence as a form of suffering. In the Mahayana, they don't. You go, like, why? He says, because, okay, if we assume that everything that changes can be called suffering, right? Why does it's impermanent? Any impermanent phenomenon is, anything subject to change is a form of suffering. They do put it like that in there, right? The Mahayana goes, well, okay, let's see. Take the Buddha's mind. Is it impermanent or permanent? All sorts of problems arise if it's permanent. It's like, how could it even know us? How could it do anything for us? There's no way. That can't sort of function. So it must be impermanent. So then it doesn't make sense to say that everything that's impermanent is a suffering. Because if you did and took it up, you go, then the Buddha is still suffering. Okay, again, so you've got to be careful. It's not so much that the impermanence of phenomena causes.
I thought that was what we said here.
Causes these phenomena. The mind is by nature, the conventional nature of mind is to be impermanent.
Is it that impermanence is unstable?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then, when you have impermanence, you've got to have an object that's impermanent. So we're not just talking about this thing that's, that's okay, let's do a meditation and we'll do the last four sections coming. So yeah, adjust the posture. But sit in a way that feels sort of calm and stable, and yet your mind is awake. Then take a few slow and deep conscious breaths. Let's do take three. Let's let the mind settle itself. Now here we're learning about this life that we have. so that we can help others learn about their lives and apply what we've learned. So start by sort of refreshing your own altruistic attitude. Now, pain and change are natural parts of an unenlightened life. And pain and change are often objects of thought and conversation. But this morning, we've been talking about and thinking about something else. How our life is not fully under our control. As long as we have a body and a mind which are conditioned by other factors, like karma and affliction, we will face change and hurt. Let's think of like a dirty glass that's in a sink. So under the bubbles and the water, it's quite safe. Or just a little bump in the wrong place or slippage from your hands and that glass will be broken. In fact, if you just leave it long enough, it can shatter. Now we have a body and a mind. Can you ever tell your body to never feel tired, to never feel hungry, and it will obey you? The answer is no. Your body will follow nature's rules and karma, not what you want. It's a bit like being a passenger in a driverless car. You can't control everything. So how can you find a stable sense of peace when things go wrong? Well, first, you need to stop putting all of your effort into trying to fix the world outside you and put some effort into training the mind. Because peace does exist. And true peace is very much like an open sky. It remains calm and open even when the clouds move through it. So today, and longer if possible, recollect that when something small bothers you, perhaps you can say to yourself, like, this is how a life conditioned works, or this is how a life conditioned functions. So if you can keep this thought with you or remind yourself of it often enough, it'll help you stay calm and equanimous. When you meet these different problems, breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and it's going to open. We have how much time we've got left?
A little over 10 minutes.
Okay, good. Okay, so I might have shown you this one last week, I'm just not sure. So these types of dukkha, they're all under the classification of true dukkha, you know, suffering of suffering, suffering of change, suffering of all pervasive conditionality. Now, all of these three sufferings exist. There's different ways you can approach them and deal with them. So when we first come into the Dharma and the study of it, we're persons of small capacity, but we don't know a great deal about it, but we're sort of learning. And our primary goals here are basically trying to be happy. But from the perspective of a person of small capacity, their real concern is this obvious suffering that we talk about, right? Obvious suffering meaning, really, suffering of suffering, and perhaps something to do with suffering of change, but not much, just really suffering of suffering. But the actual object they really need to focus on, and what's great suffering that's so terrible, is the suffering of future miseries in the lower realms. That's why, even though we don't like to read this material mostly, it's quite distressing. The idea is that you want to get your mind a little bit distressed here, because you go, guess what? It could be worse. You know, the pains and sufferings that we experience as human beings, they're nothing compared to these other sufferings you can experience. So we do that too, and the reason for doing it is to avoid it. To go, okay, that's a real potential, that could happen, and I don't want it to happen. I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen to me. I will avoid it. So what's the major thing that people do to avoid it? I was going to say, it's true. From an ordinary perspective, it's drugs and alcohol and entertainment, right? We have no, people don't much think about future lives and things like that, or you might think God or Jesus will take care of it when it's got to call his name. But from a Dharma perspective, if you're a Buddhist person, you do want to feel a little bit distressed about this future suffering to avoid it. How do you avoid it? By restraining yourself from the 10 non-virtuous actions. Don't kill any humans. Do the very best you can not to deliberately kill animals, insects, any other living thing. Don't lie, engage in sexual misconduct, harsh speech, idle speech, divisive speech, lying, malice, envy, wrong views, these sort of things. That's how you stop the miseries of the lower realm readers. Just be the best person you can be, and come to die, try to die with a positive mind. It's really important that take place, because if you don't, that's exactly what you're going to end up with, suffering through the lower realms. Positive mind prevents it, so that's how you can avoid it. Then we keep practicing, we become a person of middling capacity. And this is, like I said, obvious and subtle suffering. So the obvious suffering, of course, is the suffering of suffering and the suffering of change. Subtle suffering is the suffering of all pervasive conditionality. And that's a Buddhist thing. The others you can find in other religions, but the suffering of all pervasive conditionality is particularly to Buddhism, not to other religions. And of course, so what is it? This is like these five aggregates, our body and mind, the phenomena that make up our body and mind, called the five aggregates, are under the influence of karma and delusion. If we can get rid of karma and delusion, then the aggregates will not be under their control. This is why the teachings of the Buddha and the Four Noble Truths, like they're good news, as the Christians say, right? Is good news here. On one side, we show you how you're suffering, on the other side, how to get out. This is why they spend so much time on cause and effect. Because if you know what causes an effect, then you stop the cause, you can't have the effect. Now, for those of great capacity, those who wish to become fully awakened to benefit all of all beings, their suffering is the suffering of all sentient beings. So they're not just concerned about their own suffering or the suffering of their brothers and sisters and their parents. No, it's everyone. So they recognize that we're all the same boat, aren't we? We're all the same. So that's one aspect. But the second is this one of this lack of omniscience. Like, I'm not omniscient, so I don't actually know what to do. to really help somebody else. But that's the idea of having the omniscience, to have Buddhahood. Because without that, like I said, all you've done, what have you done? You've got rid of your suffering, but you actually don't know directly what is this, what causes the suffering of other people. So that's like, you know, like a thing. I think of this when you're, if you have somebody you really care about and they're in their suffering and you don't know what to do, that's because you lack omniscience. You don't know. So when you don't know, that's painful, isn't it? Sitting there with people you love and they're suffering, you don't quite know what to do. So this is,
Is that in the
struggle, isn't it? Yeah, I just put like this. Yeah, it was like the deities, right? And it moves across to the Mahayana. And so I try to put an ordinary person, small, middling, you could go, okay, those people who are just concerned with liberation. But if you're concerned with enlightenment, yeah, that's right, then you need a new body and a new mind. You've got to create these bodies and mind. And that's what you can do, of course.
And that deity does have omniscience.
Yeah, all these deities, that's right. They have them because they're just enlightened beings, fully enlightened beings, Buddhas.
But their minds can change.
Of course, yeah, their mind is impermanent. Now, it never changes to something that will cause suffering. It can never change to that. There's no causes there. That's all gone. The mind is always compassionate, always wise. But at the same time, like it changes, but it's wisdom and the compassion, they always say. It's always that type of mind.
Angela has a question. She asks, isn't that compassion that we're able to bear the suffering of others rather than just fixing it?
No, not quite. You've got to call that empathy. So Angela, we're talking here about how you feel it and you want to remove it. You want to take the suffering away. It's that part of compassion. Yes, you have to experience it, but you want to remove it. Otherwise, if we just feel it, like I said, that's called empathy. A lot of people just experience burnout when that happens. You know, what are you going to do? You're just going to feel terrible. Now, there are, this next question sort of deals with the question is, why is it important to meditate on suffering? So remember here, meditate, I think, why is it important to become familiar with suffering? Because you don't need to always be sitting here like this, right? Meditating on suffering. To meditate on means you're really familiar with it. And the most familiar type of suffering, what you want to really become familiar with? All pervasive conditionality. We're already familiar with the suffering, the pain. We know that we don't, like I said before, it's obvious to us. Suffering and change, a little bit different, isn't it? You know how, yeah. But this deeper one, like I said, this is the Buddhist one, the suffering of all pervasive conditionality. We've got to become familiar with that idea and cultivate that idea. Like, man, this body's like a walking wound. And so is my mind. It attracts suffering to me. Why? Because the causes were there. Now, here's the effect. So the importance of meditation. The first thing we're going to do is to get a sense of revulsion. Right? And like this is the one, like you say, I'm sick and tired of it. But for most of us, never get that feeling of that thing until you end up dying. Right? And what are you really sick of then? It's hurt, the pain. But that, you missed the point. The fact that you had the body, that's the problem. You got this body and mind. So this is from Geshe Sokpa. He says, the benefit of first recognizing the truth of suffering is that the mind eventually comes around to a feeling of utter revulsion towards the attractions of psychic existence. So I'm going to guess the way saying it's easy to generate renunciation for the pain and suffering of psychic existence because we naturally don't like it. But we do like the happiness of psychic existence, and we don't try and get rid of that. So that's the problem. We still think there's something good in psychic existence that we could latch ourselves onto, and it'll make us happy. and saying, no, but there isn't anything. Cyclic existence is the effect of, it is suffering. It's by nature suffering. But why is it? Because the causes that produce it, infusion and karma, they're both associated with suffering. They produce it. Yeah, that's right. We do, right? So we like to cheap thrills and they don't immediately hurt us.
Yeah.
They decrease our suffering, it feels good. Right? But remember, all that's happened is a decrease of the suffering.
And very often the cheap thrills have planted causes for suffering later on that we don't realize.
That's right. Yes, we do. So this is the first, this revulsion. The other thing about the importance of becoming familiar is because we want to become familiar with the root causes. We go, what's producing the cycle of existence? You know, you got karma and delusion. We have to know that. Then, of course, it's also got what they call the subsidiary causes. Excuse me. So this, for instance, would be things like independence upon our own confusion and how we react to phenomena. We create phenomena, other phenomena like anger, disappointment, doubts. So these are what they call the subsidiary causes. By learning what these are and how, and becoming familiar with them and their antidotes, then we can eradicate both. We have to eradicate karma, negative karmas, or karmas that are associated with grasping the phenomenon, and the confusion that has us grasping at that phenomenon. Hence, recognizing and reflecting on our suffering has a special beneficial purpose. It activates us to discover its root and subsidiary causes and to eradicate them by practicing the path to peace that leads to the true freedom of nirvana. This is from His Holiness's book, Approaching the Path. So meditating on suffering is a necessary psychological wake-up call that destroys complacency. And there we have leading to a state of peace. Now, the impact of dukkha on daily life and to measure it is like, this is sort of, like I said, wake you up, just because we've been like drunk, that's what they say, right? Just going along having a good time. But when you realize this, it's, you know, it's like the same book, gee, it wakes, it's like, holy heck. And that's what you want to take place, but to sober yourself up to go, right, I'll never be free. This body will keep attracting pain and harm all the way up to my death. And the only way I can stop it is by dealing with the karma and the affliction that produce this body. And so this is really why that, so that we have to be compassionate. So this is like having a compassionate look at yourself and going, wow, so it's suffering all the way through unless I do something about it. You know, so as a way of being kind to yourself, compassionate towards yourself, you have to decide, okay, if I want to stop this, I have to actually destroy the confusion and the karma that arises from it. And that's possible because we have the wisdom realizing emptiness and mind of enlightenment or love and kindness. We've got lots and lots of opponents to work with you. And this is this lovely one on got. So if you read this book called Patience Here, I want to read something to you. It had quite an impact on me. And I thought, well, maybe it might be something for you too. This is from page 61. And the heading is Geshe Chen Nawa's Four Ways of Controlling Anger. But you'll see how this still relates to this. He says, the first way of training in patience is to understand that we receive the arrows of harm only because we have created the target of non-virtue. So, you know, I'll keep going and I'll see what you think. This point requires a good understanding of karma. It relates to Shanti Davis' point, which we have already looked at, And our karma persuaded us to receive suffering. Any negative action we do is a target for the arrows of harm. Lying to somebody lays us open to be lied to in the future. Stealing from somebody means we can easily be stolen from. Even looking jealously at somebody creates a target that can be hit by the arrow of harm in the future. Our target can be hit in this lifetime or in some future lifetime, but it will be hit, and it will be nobody's fault but our own. Therefore, we should not be angry at the person who harms us, who in fact is only a condition in the situation that has manifested due to our karma. It is our own karma that is the real cause. And if we need to blame something, it's that. Because we have created the target, others can shoot their arrows of harm. If, on the other hand, there were no target, there would be nothing for the arrow to hit. By creating negative actions, we are leaving ourselves open to receive harm in the future when the right circumstances manifest. This is the law of cause and effect. That is karma. The problem is not with the harmers and their arrows, but with the target of negativity we have set up for them to fire at. It is completely our responsibility, completely our fault, and not the fault of the harmer. Therefore, there's no reason to get angry with other sentient beings. So that was, I got this image in my head while I'm walking around with this great target on my back, and I stuck it there, and it's just waiting for the arrows that I've already shot out for someone else to shoot me. And it was also, it seems like it's quite frustrating when you get people hurt you, don't they, for their language and what they say and do. But then having this, well, of course you're going to be hurt. You've got a body and mind that attract harm. And what's that? What's this big arrow you got on your back that you put there? And, you know, it made it more easier for me to accept now that I am going to be harmed by others. So this is not like an unfair thing. That's what we often think, isn't it? It's not fair that such and such did this or did that. But it's, you've got an arrow on your back. Or like to say, like this idea of like the walking wound. Yeah, so this, what I did this morning, I went downstairs and the room was dark and I walked into the desk. I've come through the door, walk over there, I didn't walk out from it up, bang, straight to the desk. And of course, hits my leg and then my leg hurts. They go, yeah, that's how it is. This is cause and effect. You've got a body that will hurt. Causes for hurt produced it.
But it was your mind that created that hurt. Otherwise, it was just a sensation.
That's just a bag on a desk.
Yeah.
And many times you hit that thing, you know, it can be quite indifferent to it, eh? And that hurts much less than if you sort of grab your leg and carry on a bit. So this walking wound is also like a good one, I think. Because if you use the analogy of the wound, right, even if it's not right now in pain, it's been treated, just the fact that you've got it. You know, anyone, if you've ever had a wound, you know how careful you have to be afterwards, don't you? You don't want to bump into anything, right? It's not hurting, but you know if you bump it, it's going to hurt. So we're like that. We've got a body and a mind that can get bumped by disturbing emotions. It's going to hurt. And again, so Kinsrupa shows you the lesson to take away from the first noble truth is you're not in control, you lack control. Of course, the idea here, of course, is that Just try and get some control. And how's that? But the control, using wisdom and using the methods. So, gosh, I've got to get so final meditation and then we'll go around. So, again, just adjusting your posture, drop your shoulders, lengthen your back. Perhaps partially close your eyes and let the body breathe itself. Create an altruistic motivation for the meditation. The first thing is to recognize our suffering. And we need to give it a name. Is this the suffering of suffering, the suffering of change, or the suffering of all of pervasive conditioning? So naming the suffering is the first step towards freedom. When we stop running from these problems, then we gain the power to solve them. And the first two truths, the truth of suffering and the truth of origin, are like a map that shows us how suffering is produced. And the true paths and true cessations are like a map to show us how you get out of the suffering of all pervasive conditionality and samsara. So then ask yourself, have you felt any physical discomfort at all today? If you have, recollect that every living being shares this vulnerability to pain. It's like a thread connecting every heart to heart on this planet. So now, time for a little inner questioning. You can ask yourself, which of your recent happy moments have already started to fade or faded? So worldly happiness, worldly pleasure is unstable by nature. If you can recognize this and remember it, then you can enjoy things like sunsets, good meals and so forth. You can enjoy them without grasping to them, without holding on. It's possible to tell your body to never grow old or tired, but can the body actually do that? Our bodies are shaped by forces beyond our control. It's just like a boat on the water being sort of carried along by the deep currents. Or like a raft in a raging river. So today, if a problem arises, try to see it as a symptom of a deeper issue. Don't look at that as a personal failing. And remember that a cure for samsara is possible once the diagnosis is accepted. So samsara is produced through karma and confusion. This is the diagnosis. If we accept that, then a cure is possible. Okay, so our takeaway today, you know, these three general types of suffering and this analogy of the burn wound. And it is important, like I mean, I know it's not a comfortable thing, it's not like a happy thing to be looking at suffering and what causes it. It's a little distressing. But we have a purpose for it. Right? We're not, it's not just to accumulate information, it's because we want to do something with the knowledge. There's an article about the Four Noble Truths in the handouts. Try to memorize or recollect this idea of the wound, right, along with these the different types of feelings, pain, happiness, and equanimity. And coming up, we're going to look at some of, you know, what are these subsidiary factors that come out of karma and confusion? These are the six root delusions. So we'll look at these and we'll look at antidotes for each of them. Okay, so I hope it's been an interesting class for you and you can take something away from it. So let's dedicate the merits that you've generated here for the welfare of yourself and all beings. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. Now, to do that, of course, we want to generate a mind of enlightenment. These next verses are about that. May the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain, to the style and souls of the world. And the last two prayers are for the great teachers, His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Rinpoche. So here for His Holiness' long life, the wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparable kind Tenzin Gyatso I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And lastly, for Rinpoche's swift return, in holding and spreading the luminous, precious and complete teachings for exploration and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discarded. Incomparable and all good to you, the Maker.